So I will just take up one topic. I've just selected a few topics which... Here is a discussion on Bhakti Yoga. There is an interaction between Sri Ramakrishna and some devotees. Sri Ramakrishna says, but until realization, one must be pure, one must renounce the world, carnality and worship of mammon. Yeah, we have to remember, Yam was a very old-fashioned scholar, trained in the classics of Western and Eastern tradition. So his language is a bit Victorian type, you find. He didn't change it. I think it was first published in the year 1907. So his own translation of his diaries, originally written in Bengali into English. Now, it's so difficult to get rid of this sense of I, which puts a barrier in the way of the absolute spiritual knowledge. Even after absolute knowledge, the released soul is forced, as we have said, by an unseen power, by Divine Mother, to come down to the plane of sense consciousness and have this sense of I, though in a thin form, attached to Him. You dream of a tiger, you tremble in every limb, your heart throbs violently. You wake up to find that it was a mere dream. But all the same, in your waking state, your heart goes on throbbing. Now here Sri Ramakrishna is going to discuss one technique which every spiritual seeker can practice, that is sublimation of the I, sublimation of ego. It's the main problem. Ego is a big problem in spiritual life. So Sri Ramakrishna's solution is sublimation of this ego. Elsewhere you find in spiritual literature, sublimation has got a very important place. Sublimation of the sense organs, sublimation of the mind, sublimation of interest. Have a very high, sublime goal in life. That's supposed to be very helpful. Now, Sri Ramakrishna says, that being the case, the sense of I refusing to leave, what should be done? Why? Let it have one sole limiting agent. Let it stay on as the servant of the Lord. So, I am the servant of the Lord. Of course, this is from the devotional point of view. Well, I am proud. I can do many things, but I do everything in the name of God. I am great because I am the servant of God. So this kind of sublimation. So we can find a classic example Sri Ramakrishna gives elsewhere. He's a mythological figure in Ramayana. Hanuman, he's a half monkey, half human being. He was a great, very powerful warrior, a man of knowledge, a great yogi. That's how he is described in this mythological work, Ramayana. He was very proud, very strong, very self-confident. But at the back of it, he had a strong conviction that he was the servant of Rama. Now, this idea can be practiced in our own practical spiritual life. Those who have got a strong sense of duty, those who have got strong sense of individuality. Sometimes it may stand in the way of devotional practices. So we can sublimate this ego sense, give it a higher dimension, a sublime spiritual dimension. Well, I am great, I am powerful, and I can do things. Not because I am what I am, but because I am the servant of God. So a link is created between our own individuality and a higher spiritual ideal. There's a link you can find. In a way, it was this sublimation of ego that worked in the favor of the great spiritual mystics who had to face a lot of difficulties, and also the great reformers who were also spiritual persons. You can find, you read complete works of Swami Vivekananda, you find. Swamiji says we must have self-confidence. See, muscles of iron, nerves of steel. You don't expect this sort of expressions from a St. Francis of Assisi or the author of Ilocalia, St. Therese of Avila. You find so much of humility, so much of self-effacing humility that you find in these mystics. But in Vivekananda you find, well, I can do things, I should do great things, I should take the message of Vedanta to the West, to spread the message of Vedanta. So you can find so much of self-confidence. In fact, once I was asked a question by a very good devotee of ours, when she read Vivekananda's books, especially most probably Colombo to Almora lectures. But Swamiji harped so much upon the need for national reconstruction, national revival, and also the need for self-confidence. Then she said, well, it looks like some kind of ultra-nationalism. Now, from a European historical perspective, nationalism is an accursed word. Nationalism was at the root of so many problems, revolutions, wars, bloodshed in European history. But when you read the complete works, whenever Swamiji speaks about the need for national revival, national reconstruction, he's speaking out of compassion for people who are divided, who are quarrelsome, and who had lost their national sovereignty due to disunity, due to lack of unity, due to lack of organizational structure. So that is needed for the survival of human beings. So there you find this compassion at the back of Swamiji's ideas of national reconstruction. See, Swamiji's words don't sound like the words of a mystic of the medieval times. Or even if you compare Vivekananda's works with Siddharamakrishna's words, you find some apparent contradiction. Siddharamakrishna says, in fact, he asks Yam and some other disciples, who are you to teach others? You go about lecturing others. Have you realized God? Have you reached the supreme spiritual goal? And you are talking about teaching others? Swamiji, on the other hand, says, we must take this message and spread it all over the world. Now, you see the contradiction? Now, coming to Swamiji, the same idea which comes from Sri Ramakrishna, which he got from Sri Ramakrishna, is given another dimension. Even the little effort that we make to spread these great spiritual ideas among people becomes a spiritual practice, no less than doing japa, taking holy name, meditation or contemplation. So spreading a great spiritual ideal itself is a kind of spiritual sadhana. So there you need to have self-confidence. You need to have some kind of ego, a sublimated, a refined ego. So there, well, I am a follower of a great spiritual teacher. I am a follower of a great spiritual tradition, and I want to spread this message among the people. Not for me, but because this message belongs to the whole universe, not whole humanity. It belongs. It should not be confined to a few technical Sanskrit books accessible only to a handful of pandits. It should be broadcast. It should be brought out. It's the common property, the legacy, spiritual legacy of the whole mankind. So you find here, what Sri Ramakrishna said, the same idea is given another dimension through the process of sublimating ego. Because without ego, you cannot work. Without feeling that I can do things, I should do things, and I should do it well, and again at the back of it, I can do it. Without that, you cannot do anything. Nobody can do anything in the world unless he feels or she feels that she or he can and must do things. So that self-confidence is an emotional dimension of the psychological phenomenon that we call ego or egotism. So egotism is given a sublimation, a refinement, a processing through which it becomes a great spiritual tool which helps us in our spiritual life. So every little effort to spread a great spiritual message takes us one step forward towards spiritual realization. Now, so that's why Sri Ramakrishna says, so this ego, this I consciousness, that I can do things, this is my duty. Well, this will continue, there's no way out. So let us give it a designation. This ego is the servant of God. So somehow a link is created, a spiritual link is created, through which the ego gets a spiritual dimension through this process of sublimation. That's why Sri Ramakrishna says, let this ego stay on as, within quotation, the servant of God. Then Sri Ramakrishna continues, but the I and mind of worldly men is ignorance leading away from God. What Sri Ramakrishna means is, I and mind, this egotism, which is not sublimated, which is not given a spiritual dimension, it becomes a terrible bondage. It becomes an iron chain that binds us to this world because it takes us to ignorance. That's why Sri Ramakrishna says, the same I and mind feel consciousness becomes a tool that liberates us from bondage. But if not sublimated, if it is pure physical ego or psychological egotism, it is ignorance that takes us away from God. You can find the Gita, Lord Krishna makes a very interesting observation from a pure psychological point of view. Nahi kasi kshanam abhi jadu tishthati akarma krita. Karyadehi avashakarma sarva pragadijayehi gunai. It's a very simple point. He says, what Krishna says is this. You can never keep quiet for one split second. Mentally and physically, you cannot do that. Even if you are even relaxing, physically totally inactive, mentally we may be speculating. So, one can never remain quiet, both mentally and physically. Kshanamabhi means not even for a split second. So action at the psychological level or physical level is inevitable, is unavoidable. And action is always linked to some kind of egotism, some kind of I consciousness. I am doing this, it's my work, which I have to do. Now, so it is unavoidable for a spiritual seeker, the beginning stage. So Sri Ramakrishna says, you establish a link between this egotism and the spiritual ideal. That means a link which connects our egotism, our I consciousness with God. And that's why he says, let this I consciousness, let this egotism remain if it doesn't leave. But give it a sublimation, give it a refinement by saying, well, I am there, I am the servant of God. This work which I am doing is God's work and I am his servant. This is a very, very practical method which everyone can follow. Then Sri Ramakrishna continues, everything is ordered by the Lord. It is ridiculous for a man to say that I am the Lord of creation, I am the master, all these things are mine. There is a philosophical background behind this statement. Generally in Advaita, the highest realization is Aham Brahmasmi. I am Brahman, I am Atman. Now, this is an intuitive inner experience which a spiritual seeker reaches at the highest level. It is not a doctrine. Now, the same idea, if it is preached by a person who has got body consciousness, who has not sublimated this ego, I consciousness, to a higher level, this kind of I am Brahman, it becomes my body is Brahman, my mind is Brahman, which is absolutely ridiculous. A great spiritual personality who has reached the highest non-dualistic experience, if he or she says, I am Brahman, it doesn't mean this body is Brahman. I am the Supreme Consciousness, which is all-pervading, which is present within me as the indweller, and which is present, omnipresent, everywhere. In that sense, without this experience, if somebody says, well, I am the Master, I am Brahman, well, Sri Ramakrishna says it is ridiculous. And then he gives two illustrations. On two occasions, God cannot help smiling. One is taken seriously ill. A sick person. His end is very near at hand. He's about to die. The doctor steps in and says to the mother, why mother, there is no cause for anxiety. I take it upon myself to save your son's life. Now here the doctor has not sublimated his ego. The doctor says, I am the medical practitioner, well, I am going to save your son's life. So it is unsublimated or non-sublimated ego. And then God smiles. The doctor does not see that it is the Lord who is bringing about the death of her son. But if the same doctor says, well, I am the servant of the Lord, so I shall be able to save your son's life. There, the ego is sublimated. That's the idea behind. Because even in that case, even if the doctor doesn't succeed, he won't worry. Well, it's God's will. He will say that. I'm God's servant. I'm not this master myself. So I'm trying. Yes, this is my job. If I don't succeed, it is this. It doesn't mean that this kind of sublimation of ego becomes some kind of negligence or indifference or laxity or lack of seriousness. It's just sublimation of the ego. So that it no more creates problem in spiritual life. Again, on another occasion too, God smiles. When two brothers busy making a partition of their lands, properties being measured, taking a measuring tape, stretches it across the earth and say, this side is mine, that side is yours. Then the Lord smiles and says, these fools, they call the land their own. They see not that every bit of the ground belongs to me. In this cosmos, which contains innumerable galaxies and planets and Milky Ways, this earth is one of the tiny planets, and within this earth, this half acre, 2 foot, 10 acres or 100 acres of land is a very, very tiny, unimaginably small fraction of the land. And two brothers are taking a tape in their hands. This is mine, that's yours. So there also God smiles. This idea behind. The idea is further brought forward in the next illustration, parable of the rich man and the steward, servant. A rich man has a garden, which he has placed in charge of a steward, a servant. When visitors look in, the servant is all attentive. He takes them through the different parts of the garden, the estate, and the house attached to it, saying, "These gentlemen are our mango trees. These are our apple orchards," and so on. "Here you see, this is our drawing room. Over there are our oil paintings and other pictures. So beautiful." Now suppose this servant does something wrong and that may reach the displeasure of his master. What happens? Do you know how he is dealt with? Why? He is immediately ordered to leave the garden at once. He is not even allowed sufficient time to bring away his wooden chest in which he must have put all his clothes and other things. Even he won't get enough time to take it along with him. And it was bear in mind, the very same man who was so warmly taking away, were talking about this land, this mango trees, this gardens, etc. So this mine or our of the servant comes of ignorance, leading away from God. That's the idea behind. Now, if you want any discussion, it's a very interesting topic because people ask the question, we have to work, and for work we need confidence. You can never sincerely, efficiently do any work unless you have the full confidence that you have the capacity to do that work effectively. That's very important. Without that, you cannot do anything. And if you read any scripture, any devotion scripture of any religious tradition, the first lesson that you learn, you should not have ego, should not be proud. Everywhere, humility is always emphasized. So how do you reconcile this? So Sri Ramakrishna says, well, this ego is maybe necessary. Of course, Sri Ramakrishna is here referring to spiritual seekers at the beginning phase of their evolution, devotional life. So give a sublimation. Sublimate this ego, this eye consciousness. So thereby you are connecting your ego with a threat to God. The threat is the process of the strong conviction, I am his servant. So that becomes a sublimation.
So this is the concept of being an instrument.
Yes. Instrument.
My work is the work of the Lord, and I am an instrument.
Yes. Practically, it means the same. Servant is an instrument through which the master gets his work done. He pays and he gets his work done. So this is a great conflict for any beginner in spiritual life. Every scripture, you read any scripture belonging to any religious tradition, humility is always emphasized. We should not be egoistic. We should be humble and all that. How can a humble person who considers himself to be a most insignificant thing do anything without some kind of ego? So to achieve great things, you need to have ego. Self-confidence is a psychological necessity. It's an ingredient for efficient work. Otherwise, you won't succeed. You have to plan. You should have a definite motive. You should focus on certain well-tested means and methods. Even planning is not possible unless you have the feeling you can and you should achieve it. So you find in management techniques sometimes maybe I don't know whether it is still popular here, but it was popular here during the time of Peter Drucker, who was management in Harvard. So an executive who may not be performing very well, business executives, they used to arrange programs in big 5-star hotels. So they'll be given luxurious suits. So every day morning, some breathing techniques, and then they have to shout loudly, raising their hands, "I can, I shall, I will succeed, I will succeed." Maybe 100 times they have to repeat.
Motivation.
Kind of auto-motivation, auto-suggestives. Peter Drunkle is no more popular, perhaps.
Drucker.
Eh? Drucker, yes. Harvard business.
He's still.
But he was in the cutthroat competition. That was the opposite of Japanese method of Mitsubishi method of management, they say, which is more humanistic, more in harmony with the human happiness, peace and tranquility. So you go on shouting at yourself, "I shall succeed, I shall succeed." Of course, here that drive and push are brought out, but they have not given much of a spiritual sublimation. Here Sri Ramakrishna says this only with reference to spiritual seekers in the context of spiritual life. Because you need an ego, the moment you turn to spiritual life, this conflict comes. People ask this question: if everything is in the hands of God, how can we plan? The moment we plan, we are taking things in our hands. We are in control of the situation, as they call it. You take things in your hands, otherwise you won't plan. So it's self-motivation. So how can you motivate yourself unless you have self-confidence? And how can you have self-confidence without a sense of ego? And how can you succeed without self-confidence? This is from the standpoint of ordinary people. So Sri Ramakrishna gives an antidote. Give it a spiritual orientation, Godward orientation. In fact, that was the unique characteristic of the mythological character Hanuman. Perhaps he was one of the most successful characters in ancient classics. Whatever he undertook, he succeeded. He never failed. He was more successful perhaps than his master Rama himself. Whatever he undertook, he succeeded. You never come across a single incident in which he failed in accomplishing what he undertook. The secret was, he was fully convinced whatever he was doing was in the name of Rama, and he was the servant of God. Rama means God, let's say. He was the servant of God. So,
what is the relationship between the ego and the mind?
Well, mind, ego, which is not refined through sublimation, is the mental conviction that I am this psychophysical mechanism and I can do everything. It may be based on the physical, the mental and intellectual faculties. So, ego is essentially a psychological elemental emotion which is positive, conduces you towards action, energy, success, self-confidence, and so on. When mind tells you you can succeed, it is I consciousness, ego. So that egoism should be given a sublimation. So egotism is essentially a mental phenomenon.
So it's out of the mind in a sense. The ego is like almost created in the mind.
In fact, ego works through mind, not through intellect. In fact, all of us live 95% of our life at the mental level, not intellectual level. Intellect actually plays a very, very minor role. Intellect may grasp an idea, but when we start living that idea, practicing that idea, it is brought to the level of mind. So mind is often the paramount instrument. One, in Vedanta, these are two dimensions of the same vibration. But I am not talking from the standpoint of Vedanta right now. But at the practical level, you find intellect plays a very minor role. So whatever we do, we first do at the mental level. planning, thinking, organizing, all this we do at the mental level. We may take the help of intellect to get ideas, but whatever ideas we get through intellect should be brought down to the level of mind. It's mind that organizes everything. What we are, very often depends upon what our mind is, not what our intellect is. It's a very interesting thing.
So the thought process starts in the mind. Thoughts come from the mind.
Yes, thought actually takes place in the mind. Thought may be determined, or it may be colored or influenced by the intellect, ideas that we gather through intellect. And after all, there is only a very thin line of demarcation between the two. But whatever we feel, it's a mental level. And it's a feeling that determines how we do things. Even how we think things is related to what we are at the mental level.
So intellect works as a police officer sometimes. I mean, we know it sometimes we may have a mind, says, let's do this, and the intellect says, no, that's not such a good idea.
If intellect can play the role of a policeman, it will be good. Very often it doesn't do. Because whatever we grasp from a great book, whatever noble thoughts, ideas that we gather, we are not able to practice because of the wide gap between mind and intellect. In fact, at the intellectual level, when we read a great book, when you get a lot of noble ideas, we have a strong desire to practice them, but we fail because when these thoughts come down to the mental level, we find it's not always possible. That's why intellect actually plays a minor role in our day-to-day existence. But for highly evolved spiritual persons, an idea may be grasped by the intellect, and that person may be able to practice it. But that's because that person has reached a very high level of spiritual growth. Where intellect and mind practically come together, the gap is narrowed. It becomes more and more narrow. It becomes wider in the case of spiritual. It is wide, very wide in the case of spiritual seekers at the beginning of their spiritual life. All spiritual practices are aimed at narrowing this gap and finally removing this gap between the intellectual and the mental. So that's why I can give an example. In the case of great spiritual personalities like Buddha or Sri Ramakrishna, you find, of course, in Sri Ramakrishna's life we can see very clearly. Sometimes he got an idea. He wanted to practice Christianity or Islam or maybe some devotional practice. It never created any problems for him because the intellect decides. Immediately mind obeys. But very often, what our intellect tries to tell the mind doesn't obey. The wide gap. If mind could have obeyed our intellect, we can be saints in no time. Because nobody in the world who won't mind being saints, who won't like to achieve great things. Why there are obstacles? Because the mind is not willing to come to the level of intellect. Mind is not willing to raise itself up to the expectations. Mind creates blocks, not intellect. It is mind that creates blocks. We want to do many things, but last moment we postpone, we procrastinate. Oh, sometimes we, in our imagination, we feel we can't do that. So, which is more powerful? Mind. But for a highly evolved person, this problem is non-existent. Whatever the intellect dictates, mind automatically follows. Body also will follow. But for ordinary, for spirit, for the beginners, the problem is there is a gap between mind and intellect, and also there is a gap between mind and body. Body sometimes is not willing to follow the dictates of the mind. So you wanted to ask, please.
Of course, kind of similar. I did have a related question, though. Sometimes, you know, you feel like you are are working without the mind being active, and you end up doing things, and then the mind kicks in, like you, it's almost like an absent-minded state, and you work on things, and you seem to do everything right, and then mind kicks in. Would that be called intellect, or that's something different?
Well, mind never becomes inactive, really speaking. Absent-mindedness is not a state where mind is totally inactive. Mind is not focused on the particular topic or particular situation. That's what we call absent-mindedness. Mind is never inactive. Even if you're if somebody is absent-minded, if a scorpion bites that person, he will feel it. If the person is hungry and thirsty, he will feel it. If sad news comes, he'll be upset. Happy news comes, he'll be happy. So, absent-mindedness really doesn't mean benumbing the mind, the mind becoming completely dormant. Mind is not focused on that particular situation. That's what we normally understand by absent-mindedness. So, of course, this is a common principle which is accepted in psychology and also in spiritual traditions. We all live at the mental level. Mean we all live at the level of feelings and emotions, not thought currents. Of course, you know, at one stage you cannot really draw a line of demarcation. But the idea is this: intellect would like our mind to accept certain things and follow, but the moment we start an effort in that direction, immediately there is a block, because mind blocks it. And well, if mind and intellect are both are ready, then body sometimes. That laziness, physical laziness. Okay, please.
Swamiji, there's this thing we've heard before, that the mind has four parts to it.
Yes.
Right? The mind, there's decisive, indecisive emotions.
In fact, you know, in a way, it's called internal organs.
Mm-hmm.
It's called antakarana,
mm-hmm.
internal organs,
mm-hmm.
which are four in number. Mana, buddhi, citta, and ahankara.
Mm-hmm.
And there, in the same vibrations, the same phenomenon functioning at four different levels,
mm-hmm.
are given these four different names. So, to give an illustration, the received illustration, the traditional illustration, if you see an object from a distance, maybe it's a pillar, but there's not enough light, you may mistake it for a human being, for the form of a human being. Now, in your mind, there are two conflicting thought currents. Is it a human being or a pillar? When you reach the stage, you fully realize, cognize rather, that is the pillar. So, when you are speculating before you reach the object, it's mind that is functioning. When you reach the object, when you come to a decision, nischayatmika antakaranavarti, means you come to a decisive level, you decide, then you understand it is a pillar. And then when you suddenly remember that this is the pillow that I saw, that I saw last week, there are two other components start functioning. You identify yourself as the one who saw the pillar last week, and you identify the pillar as the object that you saw last week. So, when you identify the pillar as the object that you saw last week, it is chittam, where the memories are accumulated, that functions. And when you identify yourself as the person who saw the pillar, it is the ego sense. Now, when scriptures talk about ego, I and mine, it is in a very general way. What I described just now is a traditional Vedantic perspective, which is used more and more in dialectical works and technical works. But in a general way, we can say mind is that which speculates, which feels, which interacts with the external objects through the medium of emotions. And intellect is that which interacts with the external objects through the medium of cognitive faculty. Cognition is very important. One is feeling at the mental level, the cognition at the intellectual level.
Mm.
But when we talk about the wide gap between the mind and intellect, or the mental and intellectual. We are talking about how we feel, what kind of emotions we have at the mental level, and what we would like to do, what we would like to feel at the intellectual level. Because the idea is grasped at the cognitive level, intellect, but that is not often accepted by the mind. We have so many things that we would like to be, that we would like to do. So many great, noble things which the intellect has grasped. We can write thesis books on what we would like to do, because we have got all these ideas and accumulated at the intellectual level. But where is the problem? When they come down to the mental level, mind creates a block. It's a mental block, as they call it in psychology. So mental blocks sometimes can be got rid of by removing the gap between the intellectual and mental. And this is possible through the practice of spiritual sadhana, through spiritual practices, by focusing on the central idea, the spiritual goal, more and more, so that the gap is removed. So that whatever we try to do, immediately we can practice. I gave you the example of Siddharmakrishna. Whenever Siddharmakrishna felt like practicing Islam, just imagine, very conservative, traditional, orthodox person, a priest who had been meditating upon Divine Mother, typical orthodox Hindu, was worshipping in a temple, he wanted to practice Islam. Now, there was no mental block for him. Suddenly, he just plunged into it. But for common people, what happens, you know, mind creates blocks. And this happens even in ordinary life situations also. Mental block is a very serious problem that is discussed among the academic circles of psychologists.
So
quick,
just one more thing about the mind-ego relationship.
Yeah.
Would it be fair to say then that the ego is sort of a reflection or a projection of the mind and intellect?
Ego is the assertive faculty.
What?
Means self-assertive.
Okay.
We assert.
Yes.
We assert. But
it has to be fed by something.
Yeah. Yes. It is fed by the ideas that we grasp through intellect, which... And also by the emotions and feelings that exist at the mental level. They together constitute what we call ego. I and mind. When we talk about I, we often feel that it is the mind that is really functioning, you know. Often, especially among cultured people, educated people, when they talk about I, they don't mean that the human body, which is 90 kilos heavy. That's not what they mean. It's not the body that they mean. It means I, the personality. So their understanding of their own individuality is more of a psychological type. So when they talk about I, they often mean their mind. This is an accepted principle. Among the ordinary educated people who are not living at the purely physical level, when they talk about I, or my people, I especially, they don't necessarily mean the body, they mean their emotions, their feelings, their likes and dislikes, their preferences, their prejudices, the world, the inner world in which they live, the baggage of emotions and feelings that they carry with them. That's what they normally mean when they use the word I, the ego. So essentially, ego means this baggage. Ego, in other words, this baggage, our understanding of what we are, that's what is actually ego. Our own understanding, our own assessment of what we are, that is one well-known, celebrated definition. That's what ego is. How we look upon ourselves. That's why Sri Ramakrishna says, in fact, he says, ripe ego and unripe ego. A spiritually evolved soul will have ripe ego. Ego is the, but it's ripe. It means I would say, well, it is also kind of sublimated ego. When they feel, when they talk about I, they don't mean in a very I in the selfish sense. They accommodate the interests, the feelings of all other fellow beings. When a spiritually enlightened person.
So
see,
what you said earlier about when someone says, I am Brahman, that's the experience level of knowing that, not the doctrine level of just saying that.
No. It's only experience. So that in Sanskrit is called anubhudivakya, means a statement which expresses inner experience. Tattvamasi is upadeshavakya. You are that Atman, that reality. It is the instruction given by the teacher. And when the disciple, after receiving this instruction, practices for a long time meditation and contemplation, it may take several years. When that disciple reaches a stage of experience, inner experience, he realizes, well, I am that reality, the Atman, the Brahman. So it is purely experience. It's not a philosophy. It's not a doctrine.
Before, there's something you said there about when ordinary people working towards that, to try to self-identify, so they begin to think that way, saying, I am Brahman, means they're looking at the doctrine part until they actually experience it.
Yes. What really happens, those who have not actually reached this experience level, when they just repeat a statement, which really is a matter of inner experience, but which they understand as a mere theory or a doctrine, and they say, I am Brahman, I am everything, there is an element of hypocrisy in it. That's a problem. So that's why Sri Ramakrishna is very emphatic on this point. We must practice what we are fit for, not what we would like to practice. If we try to practice what we would like to practice, everybody would like to have Advaita. Because that is highest. So very often, we think it's a matter of our choice, but really it is not a matter of our choice. It's really a matter of our own evolution, our own fitness. So somebody who is not actually fit through spiritual practice, so has not become fit for this highest experience. If the person says, well, I am Brahman, I am, then there is a great self-deception. Not only that, that person blocks his real path for progress. He deludes himself into believing that he has reached a stage which he has not reached. So that's one thing. Secondly, it becomes impossible for him to practice the path for which he is actually fit. That's why Sri Ramakrishna, in a very simple way, he says, people sometimes, with a strong sense of ego, well, I don't want anything less than Advaita. They feel, Sri Ramakrishna says, take the name of God and do your duty. Mentally surrendering everything to God, with one hand holding the feet of the Lord, with the other hand working the world. The simple philosophy of Sri Ramakrishna, because that's something which everyone can practice, and through this practice he or she can reach the highest goal. So that's the point. Sri Ramakrishna is very universal and very liberal and very practical, very humane and very sensitive. That's the idea.
It also says that everything happens by the will of God.
Yes.
Where does the ego come in picture?
Yes, that's why in the gospel there is a discussion of free will and God's grace. In fact, one context, I didn't find here in the context, there is a discussion of John Stuart Mill's definition of all this, essays and ethics and all that. Because Jung was familiar with these things. Now, Sri Ramakrishna says that everything is by the will of the Lord. But it doesn't mean that you should not do your duty and responsibility. Because everything is the will of the Lord, but for our own spiritual practice, for our own spiritual growth, we have to follow our path. It is not for the sake of God, but for our own path. There may be a great spiritual ideal, but it becomes ours only when we practice and realize that ideal. That's the idea behind. So fatalism is never implied in any of these scriptures. Sri Ramakrishna on the one hand says, not a blade of grass moves without his will. His capital, God's will. This is repeated over and over again in the gospel. But at the same time, Sri Ramakrishna insists that you should pray, you should do your duty, you should not run away from your work and responsibilities. At the same time, you consider yourself to be a servant of the Lord, and with a prayer in your heart, whatever you do, if you do properly, this becomes possible for you. It is for our spiritual growth. Everything is by the will of the Lord, but that's general universal principle. For us who have not reached the highest spiritual goal, it is a doctrine. It becomes a real fact in our life when we evolve spiritually. So from a doctrinal point of view, this conflict is always there. And Sri Ramakrishna says, this conflict can never be reconciled at a theoretical level. On the one hand, it's called destinianism, or fatalism. In Sanskrit, it's called Niyatiwada. There was a school of Charvakas. So those who believe that everything takes place by fate, so we have nothing to do, that is never accepted in either spiritual doctrine or in Vedanta. This is a great universal truth, but becomes a doctrine so long as we have not evolved spiritually. To make it a real fact in our life, we have to evolve. Whatever we are given never becomes ours. Whatever we earn, that alone becomes ours. A great principle in the gospel and his life. Sri Ramakrishna's, one of his greatest disciples was Swami Brahmananda, was a great spiritual personality. But he was all the time immersed in meditation, japa, and spiritual practices. And he was reputed to be a great saint. So some of his disciples approached him and asked him, Sri Ramakrishna, the master has given you everything. Then what is the need for you to practice the sadhana, the spiritual practices? Then Brahmanandaji replied, master has given me everything, but what he has given me, I should make mine. See, whatever you are given may not become your property. It becomes your property, it becomes yours only if you are fit for that. This fitness is achieved by our own spiritual practice. Otherwise, nothing becomes ours. What we earn becomes ours, not what we are given. It's a very, very important principle in spiritual life. So that's why everything happens by the will of God, that's true. But that great spiritual truth becomes a fact in our life when we evolve. Otherwise, it becomes just a doctrine. Like somebody who has not at all evolved in spiritual life, claiming I am Brahman. It makes really no sense. That's the idea behind. Any further discussion otherwise?
Swamiji, please. The difference between intellect and buddhi. What is the difference?
Well, buddhi and intellect are the same. In fact, intellect is the English word that's used for translation, translating the word buddhi.
Okay.
This normal translation is intellect. And all the emotions function at a mental level. All the emotions we may not have accumulated in this life, but they function at the mental level. Emotions may be related to what we are doing or related to the memories, which may be in their turn related to what we have done in the past, but they all function. We feel their presence at the mental level only. Yes, that's why I said, you know, we all live at the mental level. Very often, there's a big problem in spiritual life. we sometimes delude ourselves into thinking that what we have grasped at the intellectual level is in fact a fact of experience, which really may not be true. See, sometimes, and this is in psychiatry, there's a name, prophet syndrome and all that. Among many spiritual seekers, not many, I would say, at least quite a few, when they read the lives of great saints, they suddenly feel that they have become like that. Some people sometimes claim that they had similar experiences. And very often, in fact, after the passing away of Sri Ramakrishna, some of Sri Ramakrishna's householder disciples were very genuine. They were trying to imitate Samadhi, just as the master. Swamiji found out, and Swamiji exposed the humbug, and he made fun of them. Then they stopped it. Anyways, sometimes it happened. You know. Some of them wanted to sit in Samadhi. In fact, they tried. So this, they were all sincere seekers, but sometimes, you know, we delude ourselves into thinking that what we have read about, what we have seen, is really a fact of our own experience, which may not always be true. So that's a big problem, you know. Intellect plays tricks with the mind. This often happens.
Swamiji, I thought that the intellect was the only genuine thing within the mind. So if the intellect plays tricks on us,
but intellect, you need not trust intellect always. You trust Atman, which is beyond intellect.
Okay.
Yes. Intellect can be trusted only if it actually reflects the Atman, and it can reflect Atman only if it is pure.
Mm-hmm.
Like a pure mirror reflects the sun. If there is dust and filth, the mirror can give only a colored or maybe an inaccurate picture reflection of the sunlight.
And we are the last ones to know that is so. So we need someone else from outside to let us know, to make us feel.
No, if you read the scriptures, if you contemplate, and if you practice our own, according to our instructions. Sri Ramakrishna says, mind itself becomes the teacher. You know, that compass we call in ships, and you can always, what is called? Compass. Eh? It takes the ship in the right direction. So mind itself develops the faculty to guide and lead us in the correct, in the right direction. A sincere seeker can always feel it. You find this in the writings of most illustrative examples. You can find the writings of Saint Teresa of Avila and Brother Lawrence and Philokalia. The only problem in those books is, you know, sometimes mind plays tricks and obstacles are created. They always try to interpret them as the handiwork of Satan. So they try to personalize these problems and try, I mean, Satan is an archangel hiding somewhere, conspiring against God's will. That's one problem that we encounter. But in Vedantic devotional tradition, it is explained as the natural obstacles which mind throws up. Also, in the life of Buddha, you find Buddha, when he meditated under the Bodhi tree, he had to confront many such obstacles. So very often they are interpreted in a highly personalized language by some Buddhist writers. But actually these are all obstacles which come to the mind. So we need not worry much about them. They are very natural. So, I hope if there is any, there is no other response. Otherwise, we'll come to another important discussion. Here, Sri Ramakrishna is discussing the omnipresent importance of faith. Reason is weak. It's a very interesting statement. Faith is omnipotent. Reason cannot go far enough and must stop at some point or other. But faith will work wonders. Now, the point is, reason may have a place in philosophy, but experience begins where reason stops. Reason means philosophy. In Vedantic tradition, there are three levels: revealed scriptures, doctrines that we learn from books, the first stage, Shruti, Shrutya, Yukti or philosophy or reasoning. The third is experience. So, the canon, the canonical literature, then reason or philosophy, and experience. Now, we can understand the importance of experience only when we leave the realm of reason behind. Sometimes what happens, you know, we have a tendency to analyze experience through the language of reason. That's a terrible blunder, and that sometimes leads to endless doubts and skepticism and inner conflicts. This is a very, very important subject that is discussed here. Sri Ramakrishna, in one context, in the bigger book, you find somebody sitting on the bank of a river who actually wants to cross the river. There's a boat that is tied to the anchor. He doesn't do anything. He just simply sits there and says, I want to cross the river. How can I cross the river? How do I untie the chain that binds the boat to the anchor? How long should I row? And then will the wind help me? So he goes on analyzing, logically thinking and speculating. They never take a plunge. Sri Ramakrishna uses the language. He uses a somewhat strong language, you know. He was so sincere and honest. So he uses, these fellows will never take a plunge. Because they are afraid they may get wet. And they go on speculating and rationally analyzing. Now, this is the problem where when we try to reach the goal through reason. So reason is good. If reason is well guided, it's good. Otherwise, reason is like a lawyer, an attorney. Now, a lawyer, if we get a very good lawyer, he can certainly take the side of the criminal and may get him scot-free. So reason can never take us to the supreme goal. Philosophical reasoning can never take us to the supreme goal. So there's one point where reason fails. In fact, it is at this point that mysticism begins. You find all the greatest spiritual teachers had a little of this, what we normally call mystical experience, which is certainly beyond reason, which is beyond books, beyond philosophy. Here Sri Ramakrishna says, that experience is possible only through faith. It is not the faith of the ignorant, the superstitious. No. It's a faith that transcends reasoning. So here Sri Ramakrishna makes a very important statement. Reason is weak in the sense reason cannot take you to the supreme goal. Faith is omnipotent. Reason cannot go far enough and must stop at some point or other. But faith will work wonders. Now, to illustrate this point, a few examples are given. These are all from mythological stories, classical books. But they do have a place. You know, otherwise just think of the great men and women who had reached the highest peak of mystical experiences. There, you can find them in all religious traditions. You can also find them among people who are perhaps not very religious in the conventional sense of the term. Now, there's one point where they leave the realm of reason and philosophy behind and take the help of what we normally call strong faith, which takes them to the highest experience. So here Sri Rama, yes, by faith shall a man be able to cross the mighty ocean itself without the slightest difficulty. This is an illustration. Ramachandra, God incarnate, worked hard to throw a bridge over that part of the sea which separates Ceylon from the mainland of India. It's called Ramayana, the classic. But as if to prove to the world that the majesty, the omnipotence of faith, he gave it to his devotee, the great Hanuman, who crossed the ocean by the unaided power of faith. Once a friend of Vibhishana, king of Ceylon, wanted to go across the sea. Vibhishana, to whom he appealed for help, had the name of Rama, God, written on a leaf without the knowledge of his friend. He then said to his friend, "Take this and be sure to keep it tight to the end of your cloth. This will enable you to walk across the ocean in safety. But mind you, never try to look into the leaf, for you will go under. You'll be drowned the moment you open it." We know why. The moment that person opens the leaf, will find there is nothing there, only name of God written. How can this take? That moment faith is shaken. So he may have reached that the middle of the ocean on the strength of faith. The moment his faith weakened, he falls down, comes down to the level of reason, he's drowned. So without faith, without leaving the realm of reason and philosophy behind, rational analysis behind, speculation behind, one can never reach the ultimate spiritual goal. After all, here from a philosophy, if you understand it in the Western academic sense, philosophy can never come into compromise with mysticism. Impossible. At least not from 5th century onwards. From 5th century onwards, theology practically strangulated philosophy and independent thought in European tradition. The last great philosopher that Europe produced was Plotinus and Philo, the great Neoplatonist, that's it, according to. So after Augustinian theology became paramount, it became a kind of theological tyranny, there was no more independent thought till 18th century. I'm not going further into this academic background. The point is this, in Vedantic spiritual tradition, you find a reconciliation between theology, philosophy, and mysticism. That's something very interesting, because Vedanta says, philosophy cannot take us to the highest goal. There comes a point where you find philosophy can work both ways. As I said, it's like a lawyer. A very good attorney can argue on both sides. So very often it's a matter of analytical skill. In fact, there was no greater logician or dialectician in Indian philosophical tradition than Shankaracharya. Shankaracharya said, philosophy can never take you to the ultimate goal. He used philosophy as a tool. He was doing nothing but using his philosophy. But to promote non-dualistic philosophy, and he used philosophy to expose the limitation of philosophy. Because he said, beyond theology and philosophy, there is a mystical experience. It's called Swanubhuti in his own language. So in Indian tradition, you find a kind of harmonious reconciliation between theology, philosophy, and mysticism. So Sri Ramakrishna here says, the moment this person was trying to cross the ocean, on the strength of faith, lost that faith, or got his faith weakened, looked at the leaf, he may have thought, oh, this is just nothing, this leaf is nothing, just name of God is written. That moment, you know what happened? He left the level, the realm of faith behind. He brought himself down to the level of philosophy or reason, and he got drowned, that's what he says. The friend put faith in his words. He walked over the ocean for some time in perfect safety, but unfortunately, he took it into his head to try and see what precious thing was tied to the end of his cloth, which could take him unhurt over the mighty deep ocean. He opened a leaf and down he went beneath the waves. So yes, faith is omnipotent. Before it, the powers of nature all shrink and give away. Maybe one of the most classical examples is the conversion of Narendra Datta from an agnostic to a mystic. By faith only. Swamiji was trained in reasoning, in philosophical analysis. But Sri Ramakrishna taught him the limitation of reason and philosophy. Now, if there is any subject to be discussed, we can discuss.
Could you please define theosophy, philosophy?
Oh, not theosophy, theology.
Mysticism.
Yes. Theology means the study of revealed scriptures. In biblical tradition, in Christian tradition, it means the systematic study of the revealed scriptures like the Bible and other related books. In Vedantic tradition, it means the study of the Vedas. All other books are implied, but primarily our theological canon is the Vedas, which is technically called Shruti in Vedantic tradition. So Shankaracharya says Shruti is the first, mean the canonical literature. And then philosophy means philosophical analysis.
Plato
in Western tradition, Plato, beginning with Thales, 7th century, Greek thinker from the 7th century, right up to modern times. Of course, in Western philosophical tradition, you know, mostly from the collapse of Neoplatonism in the 3rd century AD onwards, every system of thought practically was subjected to the tyranny of theology. Whatever theology was willing to accept was accepted, otherwise not accepted. From 18th century onwards, there was an attempt to revolt against the tyranny of theology. One was the rational revolt under Kant, Hegel, and the German idealistic philosophers in Germany. The other was more of an empirical revolt from Britain, J.S. Mill, Locke, Hume, and others. And the third revolt was from Darwin, who questioned the biblical description of creation, the Genesis, the book of Genesis. And the fourth one was Marx and Engels. Their books also challenged the foundations of theological dogmatism. The fifth and the last one was positivists, who the school of philosophers in 19th century, mostly in Europe. So, of course, I'm not going too much. The point is, so philosophy in Western tradition always was some kind of independent succession of independent philosophical movements, each different from the other. Though Plato defined philosophy as an independent quest for truth, that concept practically died out with the emergence of Augustinian theology in the beginning of 5th century. Augustine was not willing to accept anything which is not acceptable to the biblical revealed scriptures. In Vedantic tradition, coming to Vedantic tradition, you find philosophy was always closely related to theology and also mysticism. Because all the great, most of the great philosophers, like Shankaracharya, Ramanuja, I'm talking about Vedantic philosophers, not non-Vedantic philosophers like Gautama, the exponent of Nyaya system, or Kanada, the exponent of Vaisheshika system, Kapila, the exponent of Sankhya system, Jaimini, the exponent of Mimamsa system. I'm not going to them. I'm talking about Vedantic tradition. All the great thinkers, philosophers in Vedantic tradition had an element of mysticism, and also they were great theologians. Say, as I said, you know, Shankaracharya, the greatest of Advaitin, the greatest of Vedanti, he said, his motto was this: first, you listen to the teachings of the great revealed scriptures, the theological canon, the canonical literature. Then use your intelligence, your intellect. So yukti means reasoning, philosophy. Need not blindly believe whatever revealed scriptures say. It's a very bold statement. Just see the contrast between Augustine on the one hand and Shankara on the other. Augustine lived in the beginning of 5th century, Shankara lived maybe 300 years later, 290 years later. Shankara said, just because some scriptures say something, you need not blindly believe. And he gives an example. If thousands of scriptures proclaim that fire is cold, the fire never becomes cold. Shatakodibhi yuktam ched aknehe sitalada nasya. This is a Sanskrit statement in Brahmastra. If thousands, maybe trillions of scriptures made the proclamation that fire is not hot but cold, fire never becomes cold. Similarly, you need not blindly accept whatever scriptures proclaim. You respect them, listen to them, but use your intelligence, your analytical power, your philosophical reasoning, and then you bring that into your own inner experience. Means mysticism. Experience is related to mysticism. One becomes a mystic when he becomes or she gets a glimpse of the supreme reality. In Catholic mystical tradition, in Vedantic mystical tradition, you become a mystic when you realize it as your own inner self. Jiva Brahma Ikim is called the unity between the individual soul and the universal soul. So Shankaracharya says, Shruti or theology, Yukti or philosophy or reasoning, and one's own inner experience, intuitive experience, inexplicable experience. These three have an equal place, but the last and the most important criterion is experience. Experience the last and highest and greatest criterion for believing, for truth. So that's why I said, you know, in Vedantic tradition, there's a harmonious reconciliation between theology, philosophy, and experience. You find, that's what you find in Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna says you should realize God. But Sri Ramakrishna also says that you should listen to scriptures. But you know, he also reveals the limitation of scriptures. He says, in his own very simple, humorous language, you take an almanac or weather broadcasting report. So you will have so much of rainfall in one area. But if you squeeze that almanac, that weather report, you won't get a drop of water. The weather report can't give you a drop of water. So similarly, you take all the scriptures and use all your brain, philosophize, rationalize, analyze, use your reasoning, you won't get the truth. Just as you won't get water by squeezing the weather report, you won't realize the truth just by reading books. You realize the truth only when you get the experience. That's why, you know, he reconciles, a beautiful reconciliation of theology, philosophy, and experience. This you find the teachings of many great mystics. Maybe the most, the greatest Western mystic who succeeded in harmonizing these three streams in Meister Eckhart, a German mystic. You can find, we have access only to his English translation, Rudolf Otto's interpretations of Eckhart's philosophy.
So Swami, I mean, so you should read or hear what is in the theology, and then you must make it your own in your mind. You must reason and make it your own. But then the principal tool of mysticism is really meditation.
Yes.
The direct tool.
Yes. Now, meditation, according to Vedantic, I mean, non-dualistic tradition, in the Vaishnava tradition, you know, Ramanuja, for example, he also systematically reconciled theology and philosophy and mysticism. According to these Vaishnavite philosophers, it is through complete surrender that you get this experience. Prapatyaya Saranatri, complete surrender.
Well, to reason you must change the mind, to reason you must make it your own.
Yes.
Which is, in a way, you are surrendering to the idea.
Exactly.
But then you still have to meditate to experience. The mind still has, there are still subtle obstacles at
this
point.
Yes, has to face obstacles. And great works, great theological works may come to a rescue, help us in focusing the mind on these things. That's why nothing is left out. Nothing is rejected. Reconciliation means everything is given its own place. Nothing is rejected. Everything is given its own place. But the point is emphasized that the highest criterion is experience. As you stated, theological books, great scriptures will certainly help us by giving a point for focusing our mind. We have to turn our mind and senses away from worldly objects. For that, the great philosophical books, well, theological doctrines, there are great doctrines in theology, of course, will help. But that there is a stage beyond them all, that is the inner intuitive experience. You find all the great mystics had this experience. The problem is, in European tradition, the mystics were never allowed to make the proclamation that experience is the highest criterion, because that would have gone against the theological doctrines. That would have invited inquisition, excommunication, burning at stake, and so on. That's the only difference. You find such great mystics in all religious traditions, everywhere. But in Vedantic tradition, it is openly proclaimed that philosophy and theology cannot take you to the highest goal. One should have a bit of experience. This may create some confusion in our minds. If experience is the highest criterion, without experience, everything is futile. We are reading, we are discussing. Sri Ramakrishna says, weather broadcast report cannot give us range. Similarly, lectures and reading will not take us to the supreme goal. They will certainly help us in taking us to the supreme goal. They are great help. They are very helpful, because they give us ideas. They give us a point to focus our mind, so that mind can be distracted away from the worldly objects, and mind can be given a spiritual orientation. For that, scriptures are very helpful. And not only the scriptures, especially the Upanishad literature, will help us in guiding our spiritual path. So they are very helpful. But as he said, you know, All the Upanishads, all the great philosophical books in Vedanta are unanimous in making one statement, that the reality is beyond us. Reality, the absolute reality, is not confined to this book. The book helps you a lot. Book is necessary, even essential. But experience is the ultimate criterion for spiritual life. That's the supreme goal. For us, books are very helpful because they give us a diversion, a spiritual diversion, an orientation, healthy orientation towards positive channels. Now we'll go to another, maybe 5 minutes.
What is it that converts spiritual practice into spiritual experience?
Spiritual practice, when we, in Vedanta scriptures say, when you feel that we get an inner feeling that we have reached the goal, which is called Kridarthada Kridagrityada. You find in Shankaracharya's books, you find the feeling, well, it is difficult to describe this. Experience can never be explained. It can only be experienced. But the scriptures make the statement. You feel a kind of inner contentment, which is indescribable. So, you cannot philosophically or rationally analyze what exactly translates practice into experience. But practice comes to a point where you feel that inner sense of fulfillment. It's called blissfulness. Kridarthada, kridagrityada. These terms are used. A most indescribable, inexplicable sense of inner fulfillment. We feel there is nothing more to be achieved, nothing greater to be sought after. And that's what distinguishes the great mystics from philosophers and theologians. Sometimes this is found even among great mystics who did not have any formal training in theology or philosophy. See Sri Ramakrishna's disciple, Buddha Anandaji. He's a very, practically, he was not illiterate, he knew it, but almost an uneducated person. He lived Sri Ramakrishna taught him to meditate, and he became a great saint. One day, maybe Swamiji was explaining some Upanishadic statements, which Buddhanandaji had never read it. But immediately, when the meaning was explained to him, he said, oh, yes, it is so. Now, there was no other way that Buddhanandaji could have known the real meaning or implication of those Upanishads, I mean, from Katha Upanishad. I mean, how, at the time of final spiritual liberation, you feel a kind of freedom, inner freedom. When that verse was explained to him, immediately, this great saint, who had not read any of the scriptures, oh yes, it is so, it is just as you explained. So sometimes you find this experience is experienced by great spiritual personalities who had no schooling in theology or philosophy. So it doesn't mean that you should go through this path of theology first, philosophy then, and experience. No, it can happen. Many ways. Been great mystics. One example in Christian mystical tradition I can give, his name was Luceppi. He was Saint Joseph. He was born in Italy. The place where he was born is Cupertino. It's the place, not in Bavaria. The place is named after him, Cupertino. That's the name in Italy. He was born there. Practically an illiterate person. He is the patron saint of students who are preparing for examinations. What happened, He was not willing to join a monastery. Then finally his mother, who was a strong-willed woman, persuaded him to join the monastery as a lay brother. But seeing his spiritual qualities, one bishop promoted him and made arrangement for tutoring him to become a priest. And the abbot of the monastery was not willing, but they had to obey the instructions of the bishop. He spent his time looking after cows and animals, goats, sheep and all that. That was his pastime. He was not interested. But somehow, he happened to read one parable in the Bible. The parable of the sheep that is lost. So you want sheep is lost, the shepherd will go in search of that sheep, leaving the rest behind. So something like that. That's a sheep parable. And this somehow he memorized. He didn't read anything else. Somehow this he memorized. And a junior priest was assigned to teach him, to train him. Both were appearing for the examination. Now, the examiners asked him one question, that was this parable, which alone he had read or heard. He couldn't even read other parts. And he repeated. So that's why students who are not well good at studies, when they prepare the examination, he is the patron saint. And they said he could fly. He levitate. So he is the patron saint of pilots also in America, in this country. So anyhow, but it's a real story. He was canonized after his death. Saint Joseph is the anglicized name. Saint Giuseppe of Cupertino is the name by which he is known. Yes. And now, and do you know what happened? Then he was examined, and this was the only question put to him. But he repeated the whole thing. They were highly impressed. So, but his tutor priest, who also was examined, failed. And then he was admitted. And in the whole group that went for examination, maybe for priesthood, he was the only one selected. But he was tortured because they accused him of necromancy, black magic, Satan worship. And then he was chained and tortured. But then suddenly God's grace manifested in the form, one way or other. And they could see him praying, levitating from about the ground and praying. So they were all transformed, and later he was canonized. So he was tortured. He was tried in the dungeon, one of the primitive abbeys and monasteries. So you find, you see, now here you find he was almost like Swami Adbhudananda. He was practically not illiterate in that sense, but he didn't know much about theology or philosophy, but he had experience. He used to pray to Virgin Mary. That was the only spiritual sadhana he practiced. So you can find such phenomena in different religious and spiritual traditions. But the difference is, in Vedantic tradition, the great teachers have openly proclaimed that experience is not in conflict with theology or philosophy. Rather, experience the highest criterion. Experience makes you the most respected, the most honored, and most accepted saint. Experience is not an interference of Satan. Experience, a divine interference, is called miracle. So you can find that's a great distinction of Vedantic tradition. Vedantic tradition respects experience, respects mystics, and honors them as the greatest of spiritual personalities. I hope we can continue the discussion tomorrow. It's almost 5, maybe past 5 o'clock. Thank you. Om Shanti.